Answer Coalition. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetäwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines this hour: Iran says there is nothing secret about new construction at Natanz site, and that the IAEA is fully informed of its efforts to tighten nuclear security. Israel strikes Gaza again. The live report coming up from Gaza City. Also, Russia accuses the EU of manipulating Ukraine over its membership bid after the European Commission offered a candidate status to Kiev. Good to have you with us. Iran says it has already informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of new construction around Natanz nuclear facility. A spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says it's moving its centrifuge manufacturing plant to a site near Natanz for security reasons. Behruz Kamalvandi says the relocation is part of measures to tighten security around nuclear facilities. They come after the terrorist operation that damaged the centrifuge plant in Karaj last year. Earlier, the New York Times reported that Iran is constructing new facilities deep under mountains that are able to withstand bunker-busting bombs and cyber attacks. A U.S. think tank says Israel's strategy on Iran has been a total failure, warning that Tehran's sharp response to the regime's provocations could spark a regional confrontation. In an article on its website, the Atlantic Council said there is a growing gap between the statements of senior Israeli officials and the reality on the ground. It said a recent report by the UN's Atomic Agency reveals the depth of Iran's progress in its nuclear program, despite Israel's efforts to thwart it. The futile endeavors include various covert operations such as sabotage and assassinations, and a threat to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. The piece also said Iran's oil revenues under the current sanctions regime illustrate the failure of the Israeli-backed U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Journalist and political analyst Sayed Mohsen Abbas tells us how Israeli belligerence has resulted in a more powerful and advanced Iran. Take a listen.
Well, I think it's been an abject failure, quite clearly, in spite of the fact that they have had the ability to occasionally assassinate in cold blood scientists, you know, Mohsin Fakhrizadeh being the most prominent. They've had the audacity to also reach out and basically target kill Hassan Saeed Khodai, an IRGC officer who was in charge of missiles programs. And so, of course, what they're doing is they're extending their exceptionalism that they have to go out and assassinate and kill Iranians wherever and whenever they wish. Of course, Qasem Soleimani, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, was the prime case of that happening as well. However, what has it achieved? Everything Israel has done in terms of trying to eradicate Iran's ability, its national sovereign right, in fact, to self-defense through missiles programs, through nuclear energy even. All of these things are part of the norm of the civilized world. But what has Israel achieved by all this? In fact, they've just accelerated, first of all, the process of Iran's commitment to increasing its security power, its military and technology power. They've accelerated Iran's necessity to defend its borders, and Iran is very capable of doing that through asymmetric warfare, which was something which the Israelis and the Zionist American alliance did for many, many years before. And they've the Iranians' Quds Force, the IRGC's Quds Force, has achieved huge victories on every arena that it's come up against the Zio Western imperialist empire. So, in fact, everything that they've been doing has just backfired constantly, and even cyber attacks, Iran is able to give pound-for-pound responses, and they have been doing this.
Today marks the fifth anniversary of an Iranian retaliatory missile strike on Daesh terrorists. In June 2017, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps fired missiles at a group's positions in Syria in response to the terror attacks in Tehran, which were claimed by Daesh. More in this report.
The moments when Iran launched missiles from inside its territory toward Daesh terrorists' positions in eastern Syria. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps said it fired surface-to-surface medium-range missiles into Syria's Deir ez-Zor province from its air force bases in the western provinces of Kurdistan and Kermanshah. The IRGC announced that many Daesh terrorists were killed in the strikes, adding that a large amount of their weapons, ammunition, and systems were also destroyed. The IRGC said in a statement that the missile strikes were in retaliation for the Daesh-claimed terror attacks in Tehran, which killed 18 people. The statement warned Daesh and its regional and international supporters of the consequences of carrying out terror raids against the Iranian nation.
The message of this revolutionary and punitive measure is crystal clear. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warns the Tekfiri terrorists and their regional and transregional supporters that they will be engulfed in the revolutionary wrath and the flames of revenge of the guardsmen of the revolution if they repeat their evil acts against the Iranian nation.
Experts say the missile strikes showed Iran's military might in fight against terrorists.
This attack showed Iran's wide variety of choices that it has with regard to the fight against terrorism, especially ISIL. It showed both the terrorists in Syria and elsewhere, as well as their supporters, that Iran has a wide variety of options available in order to hit back and also in order to control the war in Syria.
The Islamic Republic has been leading the fight against terrorism by helping the Iraqi and Syrian governments in their battles against Daesh and other terrorist groups. The Iranian officials have time and again stressed that had Iran not stood against the hot spot of terrorism in the region, the country would have faced severe security problems. This was the first time Iran launched retaliatory missile strikes against terrorists outside its soil. Tehran says it reserves the right to take further steps against terror groups if they seek to cause insecurity in the country.
Now, Now to Afghanistan, where three explosions have struck a Sikh temple in the capital, Kabul. A temple official says at least 30 people were inside the building when the blasts happened. The Taliban have not yet confirmed the explosions. No word on possible casualties or claim of responsibility either. Witnesses say gunfire ensued after armed men attacked the temple. On Friday, at least one person was killed and seven others wounded in a bomb blast in the northern Kunduz province. It hit a mosque during Friday prayers. A string of bombings claimed by the Daesh terror group has targeted religious sites in Afghanistan in recent months. The Israeli military says it has struck targets in the besieged Gaza Strip in response to rockets fired from the territory. For more on that story, Ashraf Shannon joins us now from the Gaza City. Ashraf, it's good to talk to you. Hope everything is fine. So tell us more. Over to you.
Yes, I mean, the Israeli fighter jets carried out a number of airstrikes against the Hamas security post in the Gaza Strip since the early hours of today, completely destroying several of these posts in the east of the enclave and east of Gaza City, and also east of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beth Hanun. These airstrikes and attacks come only about less than a day after Israeli drones attacked the Gaza Strip as well as tanks. Today's attacks, regarding today's attacks, the Israeli regime alleges that a rocket that was fired from Gaza and hit the city of Ashkelon in the north of the Gaza Strip, although no one has confirmed in Gaza firing rockets. Meanwhile, Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem reacted to the airstrike, saying that these Israeli attacks are is a continuation of the Israeli aggression against Palestinians all over Palestine. And he said that the Palestinian resistance will continue to fight the Israeli occupation until the liberation. He also talked about the fact that these attacks come just one day after Israeli regime forces killed three young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Many here in Gaza over the last few days have expressed fears regarding a possibility of maybe another Israeli war on Gaza, as Israeli military commanders have been issuing statements saying that they expect a surprise attack from Gaza that could spark a new war on it.
Thank you so much. So, as you said, on Friday, three men lost their lives and were killed in Jenin, and Hamas on Friday vowed revenge. So is there a possibility that Hamas has fired this rocket from the Palestinian territory? This is one thing. And another, do we know anything about the damage that was caused by the airstrikes carried out by the Israeli forces?
All we know for sure is that that yesterday Israeli drones attacked Gaza and tanks attacked Gaza. It is possible that the rocket fire from Gaza was a retaliation to that yesterday's Israeli attack on the enclave. We're still waiting for any information from resistance groups if anyone claims responsibility. But so far, no one has claimed responsibility for such a rocket attack from the enclave.
Ashraf, thank you so much for joining us and for the information that you gave us. Please stay safe. That was Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza City. Now, moving on, the U.S. president shrugs off criticism over an upcoming meeting with the Saudi crown prince on the sidelines of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit, despite the kingdom's poor human rights record.
The same way I've been handling it. I'm not going to meet with MBS. I'm going to an international meeting. And he's going to be part of it, just like there were people part of the discussion today.
The Saudis, however, say Biden will hold a one-on-one meeting with Mohammed bin Salman during his planned trip to Riyadh in July. U.S. lawmakers, including some Democrats, have criticized the visit, citing his promise to put human rights at the heart of his foreign policy. Rights advocates also say Biden's trip could embolden Saudi Arabia to crack down on dissidents abroad and restrict civil liberties domestically. The Russian president has warned that Ukraine will turn into a semi-colony of Western countries if it goes ahead with joining the European Union.
The Ukrainian economy is structured in such a way that it requires very large subsidies and aid. And if it does not protect the international market, it will end up becoming a kind of semi-colony. This is my opinion. But at the same time, Ukraine will receive a lot of support for current expenses.
Vladimir Putin issued the warning after the European Commission recommended giving Ukraine a candidate status for joining the EU. Putin, however, said Moscow has nothing against the country's possible membership of the bloc. The Russian Foreign Ministry also accused the EU of manipulating Ukraine over its membership bid. Kiev's push is backed by the French, German, and Italian leaders, but launching accession talks requires unanimous approval from all EU member countries. Leaders of the 27-nation bloc are set to discuss the matter at a summit in Brussels next week. As the Russian and Ukrainian armies fight for control of the Luhansk region, our reporter Johnny Miller is on the ground there to tell us more about the latest developments. Johnny, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us. Where are you right now and what's going on?
So I'm in Donetsk at the moment. You can hear the sporadic incoming of fire as the Ukrainian army shells Donetsk. Yesterday, it was in the Kavievsky district, not far from here, which was shelled for large parts of the day. Not too many casualties as people were able to find shelter. Today, this morning, it looks like to be the Leninsky district. I could see the rising smoke outside my window earlier. So there's a lot more shelling by the Ukrainian army of Donetsk in recent days and weeks. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is because NATO weapons have been able to reach the front line and so have been able to shell the center. Now, Vladimir Putin yesterday, speaking in St. Petersburg, was mainly speaking about the economy, but he also made a comment about the shelling in Donetsk. And he said this, that the shelling of Donetsk by the Ukrainian army would end when the Russian army is able to come down from the north of here and attack the heavily fortified positions on the outskirts of this city. Now, in saying that, he rather gave away Russia's battle plans, but they're no secret anyway. The early stages of this war, Russia took Ukraine by surprise by sending troops in from the north and the south around Kharkiv. But now it's very clear what Russia's trying to do, and that's to take the rest of Severodonetsk and then to sweep down here, take the rest of Donbass. That's the most likely thing that's going to happen. Just hear more incoming outside my window. But that's the most likely thing that can happen. But Ukraine is putting up a fierce resistance, and NATO, of course, is supplying it with all the heavy weapons it can. Some of those weapons, quite clearly, are making it to the front line.
Correct. Thank you so much. So what is the situation like in Lysychansk and Severodonetsk right now?
Yeah, so it's been quite quiet up there the last couple of days. There's been attempts to evacuate civilians. There's also Ukrainian soldiers held up in another steel plant. There's been reports that they are starting to surrender. Civilians have been trying to evacuate. Both sides blame each other for shelling those evacuation routes, but it's been quite quiet there as Russia, I think, tries to solidify its control of Severodonetsk before they start making another push further south. Lysychansk is basically the last town that Russia needs to take in order to take the whole of the Luhansk region, and then they'll start pushing down to Donbass.
Johnny, thank you so much for joining us and for all the information. That was Johnny Miller, a correspondent in Donetsk. Moving on. New information will be submitted to the court as WikiLeaks appeals the UK's decision to extradite the organization's founder, Julian Assange. Assange's brother says the evidence includes a CIA plot to kidnap and assassinate the WikiLeaks founder and how his lawyers were subject to espionage. The abduction and assassination were reportedly plotted when Assange was holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He is currently held at a prison in London. Washington wants to put Assange on trial for the publication of confidential files in 2010 and 2011. They revealed how U.S. forces killed civilians in unreported incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks has called the U.K. government's decision to approve the extradition a dark day for freedom of the press and for British democracy. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
Speaking to the Knesset, the European Parliament president failed to address Israeli regime's ongoing violations of Palestinian human rights. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Sami Abu Shahada, Palestinian activist. This article is published under the heading, "Once Again, Europe Reveals It Has Surrendered to Israeli Regime. Here's more." The address delivered by the President of the European Parliament, Roberto Metsola, to the Zionist regime's Knesset last month might have been one of the least responsible speeches heard from a foreign leader with regards to the Israeli regime. coming from Malta, a country that has traditionally expressed solidarity with the Palestinian people and representing a bloc that has pushed a values-based foreign policy, rule of law and accountability, Metsola could have been expected to speak truth to power. Instead, we heard the opposite. A European surrender to the Zionist regime's policies of annexation and apartheid, as denounced by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Paying lip service to the two-state solution at the end of her speech did not change the fact that Metsola failed to mention the terms occupation, colonization, or annexation, nor did she discuss Palestinian rights, international law, or UN resolutions. Her message was clear. Europe-Israeli relations will not be affected by the Zionist regime's systematic crimes and violations of Palestinian human rights. She adopted the Israeli Zionist narrative completely, something we would have expected from an Israeli regime official delivering a speech to the European Parliament and not the other way around. Metsola missed no opportunity to reaffirm her position. She showed great admiration for former Zionist regime's prime minister, Golda Meir, who infamously said there was no such thing as Palestinians, and did not address the more than 65 Israeli laws that discriminate against Palestinian citizens, including the racist ban on Palestinian family reunifications approved in March. Metsola did not even mention Shirin Abu Aqile, the Al Jazeera journalist, shot by Israeli regime forces last month, and made no public call for justice. Her speech was all about reassuring the fake regime of Israel that apartheid won't harm bilateral relations. Metsola also spoke of common values and Europe's deep bond with the regime of Israel. Did she even think about how Palestinians would feel about this? What values are shared? The denial of rights, colonization, opposition to equality, demolition of homes, separation of families? If she meant justice and equality, then she knows very little about the fabricated regime of Israel. Unfortunately, Metsola is not alone in her position. Whenever the EU implements any kind of accountability in the Palestine context, it is always against the Palestinian people. Oliver Varhaley, Hungary's member of the European Commission, has criticized the content of Palestinian textbooks and pushed a freeze on European aid to Palestine. He is not a lonely anti-Palestinian voice in the EU. The question of Palestinian textbooks is a political talking point used by those who oppose the very existence of Palestine. When it comes to the fake regime of Israel, the word of right-wing think tanks and even settlers seems to have more weight in Brussels than the reports of international rights groups on Israeli regime apartheid. Even the EU Court of Justice ruling on the labeling of settlement products is not being implemented. So what credibility could Europe have when it comes to taking a position on the two-state solution? To most European countries, the savage attack by the Zionist regime forces at Abu Aqile's funeral cannot be justified, and many were surely shocked to see thousands of Israeli Jews chanting "Death to Arabs" during the recent Al-Quds flag march. Such sins cannot be separated from the daily realities of occupation and laws promoting a system of Jewish supremacy on both sides of the 1967 border. Europe, the Zionist regime's main trade partner, has enough tools to bring about change, including by implementing Article 2 of the EU-Israel Trade Agreement, which conditions its implementation on respect for human rights. Peace is a construction based on justice. If Europe continues to avoid holding the Zionist regime accountable for its systematic crimes and violations, the status quo of apartheid will remain intact. Those are not the values we were told Europe stands for.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nation. Part 1.
On May the 5th, 1961, American astronaut Alan Shepard piloted the first U.S. manned mission into space. Americans looked up to the skies with optimism of discovering new horizons, new possibilities. Well, some Americans, anyway. As at the same time of this hope for some, there was despair for many who had a different reality. It was a society of black and white, stark contrast of a segregated society, separate but definitely not equal. What do we aspire for when we brag about conquering space, but at the same time want to conquer and rule over others? Who are we when we are proud of going towards the stars but continue to create havoc on Earth? No other species on Earth except mankind treat their own the way we do. Until it was decided by the people that it was time for a change, blacks started to strike and take to the streets to try to bring about the more equal society.
We will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Ultimately, Dr. King was able to get the Civil Rights Act signed by the president. And around 50 years later, this would lead to having a black president in the White House. So, was King's dream achieved? Missouri, a state which was not only a slave state, but was the last one to outlaw slavery. A state of historical significance, because though it was a slave state, it bordered free regions. Missouri, a state where St. Louis and Ferguson are located. Missouri, like other parts of the country, was built on the backs of black slaves who provided the labor for the new land, but who definitely did not share in its opportunities. And speaking of slaves, are you familiar with the story of Dred Scott, who was a symbol of black resistance in the past? Interesting, Dred Scott. You now have a main street in your name. Actually, it is near the courthouse where you contested being a slave in 1857. Remember walking up these steps and thinking, what would come? Will they decide in your favor? Will you be considered a human being? Will they give you the freedom that God had given you, but the white man had taken away? You were going up against a system which believed in the superiority of whites, but you insisted on your rights to be free even based on their own laws. But would they be fair? Could they give you the freedom that you deserve? How does it feel, Dred Scott, to be facing your enemies and to have your fate of freedom being in their hands?
Everyone please rise for the honorable judge to take his seat. This court will come to order. Scott is suing his owner, Mr. Sanford, to be a free man.
I own Dred Scott. He is my slave. He is a Negro and has no rights.
Why can't I be free? I live in a free state, and according to the law, I'm not a slave.
We worry every day that maybe our owner will sell one of us and divide our family. I have kids. Why can't we live like all of you?
But you are not like us. You are a Negro. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, a Negro cannot sue because he is not considered a citizen. You have no rights, which a white man has to respect.
Your mom made that?
Yes, He wound up, as you can see, the dark spot, I think it's right in here. This is about where his head was lying.
Oh, man.
The truck was pouring about right here.
Okay, so we know what they're saying that. Did you see Mike put his hands in the air?
He had them, basically.
He had his hands up.
Right, he had his hands up. After he hit him there, it's when he turned, because he looked like, damn, I've been shot. He was standing right there. The man had his hands. He didn't have them all the way up in the air. He had them shoulder lift, but he had them out. Like, okay, you got me. I'm giving up. And when he stepped off there and he said, get down, because Mike was coming forward, he shot. It was murder.
So why do you think nobody's been indicted?
The prosecuting attorney gave a description, and if you listen to him, he was talking more as a defense lawyer, not as a prosecuting attorney. His father was killed by a black man.
The prosecutor.
We knew from Jump Street that that man was not going to be prosecuted. Oh. His mother stood right there. Tape was from that tree around. She had to sit there and watch her son laying in the street in the heat for 4.5 hours.
He is one of the many eyewitnesses who said that the killing of Mike Brown was murder and that Mike had his hands in the air. However, there were no cameras rolling to capture the actual moment when Mike was killed. But cameras were rolling here, though it seems surreal, where another black man was executed. In the killing of blacks by police, rarely is anyone indicted for murder. Also, in the case of Mike Brown, his killer, Darren Wilson, was never charged. Brown is dead, and Wilson became a millionaire from contributions by some whites. Some of these same people showed their support for police by putting up signs, "I love Ferguson."
You can't just charge him anyway just because what happened was tragic. And that was the decision that was made, and I have complete confidence and stand fully behind the decision that was made by the Justice Department on that issue.
Make absolutely sure that any president that's ever elected was not elected by the people. He was picked by the private organizations and corporations. He has to take care of them. He doesn't have to take care of you.
Though blacks continue to be targets of police brutality, this does not stop them from trying to organize to fight against this oppression. One such group is this one near Ferguson. They concentrate on resistance and education as the keys to their liberation.
I dehypnotize the masses that has been put to sleep by constant hypnotic suggestions, by the systems strategically constructed silent weapons that electromagnetically attract our eyes and glue them to the television. Ears are tuned into radio frequencies permeating confusing negative energies, conjuring visions telling lies to our minds, seducing commercials that masterfully advertise, subliminally appealing to the third eye, grabbing our attention and feeding our desires to buy, buy, buy.
My father and his family were victims of the riots in East St. Louis in 1917. Slave name of Catherine. I was named after my grandmother, who died getting across the river with her children on a raft. The system helps breed segregation and racism. We cannot be blind and ignorant to racism. It's here. We're not wild animals, but we have been domesticated and bred in such a manner that we don't have the ability to stand up for what is right. So I don't see how working within the system is going to make a change. I think we have to develop a whole new approach.
The death of Michael Brown, you thought, what? What came to your mind?
Fear. I have grandsons. I made it through with my husband and my brothers, but I have grandsons. I had daughters. I had asked God to give me daughters. I didn't want them to face what I saw black men face. Now I have grandsons. It struck fear. Then it made me angry. Angry. Angry to do something. I'm looking at the police all the time over my shoulder. I don't feel safe.
Two types of people that I worry about when I walk the street. That's a criminal and that's the police. With a criminal, I know I can defend myself, but with the police, you know, even if I try to defend myself, I will be killed.
Grabs it. That's when two officers split off to take her into custody, while another four to continue to struggle with the man. The video shows four officers trying to hold the man down. Then you hear a taser being fired, and then suddenly there are at least five shots at extremely close range.
It's so strong, the hate. The hate for black life, for black men, for black people.
So when you saw, for example, with Mike Brown being killed?
I saw myself. I saw myself, just him laying there in the middle of the street those 4.5 hours. I saw myself dead in the street.
When the Michael Brown incident and Eric Garner and all of that happened, I didn't expect a reaction. Like, when people were protesting, that's when I joined in. It was ironic because the night of the indictment, there was and he's like, do you think he'll be indicted? And I told him, no, he is not going to be indicted. If you read a history book, you know he's not going to be indicted, but nobody was going to be going to prison anytime soon. So many people, they don't know how lack of their history affects them. Harriet Tubman trying to free enslaved Africans. She could only help free some. The rest are like, I'm too scared. I'm not going to go anywhere. Why don't you give yourself the best so you can give it to your children? Okay, the schools are closing down. We have carpenters in our community. We could just build a school. We have teachers there. We could have them teach at the school. We have to get a point where we see the resources and talents that we have and just use them. Because I've been in a lot of groups, and all they do is talk, talk, talk about the money, the money. I don't know how many millions, billions of black people, each of them give a dollar. Get together, set out a plan, say, you do this, you do this, you do this, it's done.
Hampton was a 21-year-old chairman of the Illinois Black Panthers. The Black Panther Party was striving for the independence of blacks and implemented many social programs.
My name is Akua Njeri, formerly known as Deborah Johnson. I'm the widow of Chairman Fred Hampton.
Can you run me through that, exactly what happened?
Well, on the night of December 3rd,
someone came into the room, started shaking the chair. Said, Chairman, wake up, the pigs are laughing.
The pigs had knocked on the front door, and Mark Clark said, who's there? And the response came back, Tommy. Mark Clark said, Tommy who? Tommy Gunn. They kicked the door in and just started shooting.
And I saw bullets coming from, it looked like, the front of the apartment, from the kitchen area.
I could see, like, sparks going in front of the doorway, like shots. I could smell cordite from all the gunshots, and our bed was vibrating like this.
They kept calling out, stop shooting, stop shooting. We have a pregnant woman, a pregnant sister in here. At that time, I was 8.5 to 9 months pregnant. My baby was to be delivered in 2 weeks.
The pregnant sister was my mother-to-be, then Deborah Johnson, now Akua Njeri. She's 8.5 months pregnant with me at the time.
Anybody that's been under gunshot know that 5 minutes is 5 hours. You think it's forever. Mm-hmm. And I found out later that this whole assassination took a total of maybe 15 minutes.
Heard a pig say, he's barely alive, he'll barely make it. They started shooting up, shooting again. I heard a sister scream. They stopped shooting. Pig said, he's good and dead now. The pigs were running around laughing. They were really happy, you know, talking about Chairman Fred is dead. I never saw Chairman Fred again.
And I remember saying to myself in my head, you better not stumble, you better not fall, because they will shoot you and say that you're trying to get a gun. So I'm trying to walk, I'm very pregnant, and we're coming out, and there were two lines of pigs I had to walk through. One of them grabbed my robe open, and they started laughing, and they said, what you know, we got a broad here. They grabbed me by the hair and slung me into the kitchen area.
As soon as Sergeant Daniel Groth and Officers James Davis, who were leading our men, announced their office, occupants of the apartment attacked them with shotgun fire. The officers immediately took cover. The occupants continued firing at our policemen from several rooms within the apartment. Thereafter, three times, Sergeant Groth ordered all his men to cease firing and told the occupants to come out with their hands up. Each time, one of the occupants replied, shoot it out. and continued firing at the police officers.
People came through the apartment because they didn't believe the reenactment that then state's attorney Edward Hanrahan was doing, where he talked about how the police were met, his brave police officers were met with a barrage of gunfire from the vicious Black Panthers. And people lined up all around the block to come through and see. And through the state's own sticks, they put these sticks in the holes. Through the trajectories of the bullets, they could see 90% of the shots were aimed at the head where Chairman Fred slept.
The account that we made public yesterday gives a detailed explanation of what happened in that apartment. I stand wholeheartedly behind it as absolutely accurate.
There is one inconsistency in, well, for example,
I do not intend to quibble about that account.
You intend to get at the truth?
The account that we gave of the events is the truth.
After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the 5 indictments.
Back then, we called it police brutality, and a more appropriate term for it is police terrorism, because as mothers, we don't know if we send our children to the store if they're going to come back or not, or if they'll be shot.
In the limelight.
By late May, the situation had become so critical that some American states, including New York, declared a state of emergency due to the shortage of infant formula, which compelled the U.S. president to order the import of the basic commodity with military aircraft from countries such as Germany. We now present you an article written by Mohammad Mahdi Abbasi, an Iranian researcher focusing on American affairs. The piece is titled, From Operation Fly Formula to Biden's Popularity Plunge. Welcome to US 2022. Operation Fly Formula may sound odd to you, but it is actually the name picked by US President Joe Biden and the White House for an operation launched to speed up the importation of infant formula to the country. Under the operation, the US Department of Defense, the Pentagon, is partnering with other departments to pick up overseas infant formula to help ease the dire shortage inside the country. More than 100,000 pounds of this basic commodity has been imported to the United States in several stages. But what is behind the formula shortage that has forced the so-called world's largest economy to resort to imports? It was 14th of May when photographs and reports about a severe shortage of infant formula in the United States went viral for the first time. The figures during the first days of the crisis show that in 25 states, 40 to 50% of baby formula products went out of stock, and in many regions across the states, more than half of the stores were out of the product. By late May, the situation had become so critical that some states, including New York, declared a state of emergency due to the shortage, which compelled the US President Joe Biden to order the import of the basic commodity with military aircraft from countries such as Germany. Following the nationwide shortage, the Biden administration faced a barrage of criticisms as the dire situation cast doubt on the administration's competence more than ever. House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik delivered remarks on the horrific nationwide baby formula shortage, saying that President Biden has continued to pass the buck. Children, babies, have been put to bed hungry, while parents are desperately trying to find alternative formulas that are often difficult to procure. This is not a third world country. This should never have happened in the United States of America. Damian Lee, an American professional basketball player, also said, "It's sad. The world that we live in, it's easier to get a gun than baby formula right now," referring to the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, which left 19 children and 2 schoolteachers dead. "That's unbelievable in this country that we live in." The criticism continued even after the shipments of infant formula arrived in the United States. When 78,000 pounds of infant formula arrived in the U.S. from Germany, Republican Derek Van Orden, a candidate running for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, said, "When the richest country in the world has to use military aircraft to import baby formula, something is wrong with the government. Biden has broken America." Former U.S. President Donald Trump also did not miss the opportunity to blame the current administration, and in a statement, criticized the formula shortage. Issued through his Save America Political Action Committee, Donald Trump said in his statement, "The Democrats are sending another $40 billion to Ukraine, yet America's parents are struggling to even feed their children." The former president further said, "No one is talking about the baby formula shortage in the United States, which he said is a national disgrace. It is unthinkable that in the year 2022, American families are unable to get baby formulas for their children." You may wonder how the United States has reached such a critical situation in supplying infant formula. To answer this question, various factors contributing to this issue need be mentioned, including the global food supply chain crisis, which is primarily attributed to the coronavirus pandemic and the closure of important baby formula factories in the United States. Interestingly, 4 major companies control 90% of the infant formula industry in the United States today, with Abbott factory being the biggest producer. The large company shut down its Michigan factory due to possible bacterial contamination, resulting in the infection of 4 infants who consumed its products, further deepening the baby formula shortage crisis across the United States. Nearly a month after the nationwide crisis in the United States, store shelves in many American stores are still bare of baby formula. Recently, Blair Hayes, an author and a mother, wrote in The Guardian that she traveled to 4 different cities to find a canister of formula for my baby. In the meantime, the U.S. President Joe Biden said in an interview recently that he was not personally aware of the severity of the infant formula shortage until early April. That interview, along with other contradictory remarks by Biden administration officials, further fueled public anger directed at U.S. federal government and dealt a final blow to the lifeless body of Biden's popularity. According to numerous reliable polls, Joe Biden's approval rating has dropped to below 40%, and the continuation of such a critical situation, of which inflation and formula shortage are merely a portion, can come at the cost of a crushing defeat for the Democratic Party in the 2022 elections, or even Joe Biden's resignation. A new opinion poll has found that most Americans say the economy and inflation are the primary factors in determining how they will vote for Congress in the midterm elections this November. U.S. inflation rose to its highest level in the past 40 years in March and currently is hovering around 8%. American consumers have been significantly affected by the rising cost of basic goods and services, including gas and food. In the latest ABC News Ipsos opinion poll, more than 80% of the American public said the economy and inflation were an extremely or very important factor shaping up their vote this fall. President Joe Biden has received low approval ratings for his handling of these key issues, suggesting trouble for the president and the Democratic candidates ahead of the midterm elections. The opinion poll found that slightly more than a third of the American public, 37%, approve of how Biden is handling the economy, and even fewer approve of his handling of inflation and gas prices, 28% and 27% respectively. The latest jobs report says that the U.S. economy added 390,000 jobs in the month of May, while the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported on Friday, 10th of June, the unemployment rate remained unchanged at 3.6%. President Biden praised the jobs report as excellent, but acknowledged that many Americans were worried about the status of the U.S. economy.